Shut up!
This is Brock and Saul.
Brock Heward and Marcus. Sorry about just
Mike.
On Seattle Sports.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio.
You were not exactly Joe Cap there in the pocket.
Presented by Simply Seattle.
Now here are your hosts, Brock Heward and Mike Saul.
All right, let's go. Brock and Saul Show, Seattle Sports on 710seattlesports.com and the Seattle Sports app. Plus, of course, all the podcast platforms out there, wherever you get our podcast, we appreciate it. Download it, subscribe. Make sure you listen to Jeff Passan from yesterday, Scott Servais from yesterday. We got some good stuff coming up today with Scott Van Pelt, going to join us from Augusta at 7:30 and Bruce Feldman at 9:30 on his latest mock draft. So a lot of fun things. Unfortunately, I've got to start the show by asking you guys this question. Is it okay if we just rerun shows every day? Now, I know that at 6:30 every day, we do play you guys a replay. Now, that is the Brock and Salk replay. We do it on purpose. We're looking to help out a group of people that may have missed the best interview that we did the day before. So, you know, we do it early in the morning, and that's sort of part of our show. We've built that in on purpose to try to, you know, maximize our ability to let you guys hear what we do. How would you feel if we just ran the same show every day? And the reason I ask is that it appears the Mariners are doing that.
Oh, okay.
They're just playing the same damn game every freaking day for 12 games now. Yeah. They're just rolling out the same game. I don't just mean the same players. I mean, they're literally playing the same game. The same lousy offense, the same crappy pitching, and the same defense that nobody should ever have to watch. Why are they just playing the same game every day? At least find new and different and creative ways to lose. Don't keep doing the same thing every day. This is the same show. Mm. It's bizarre.
Usually say that's the definition of insanity, but it sounds optical like illusion. It's driving you insane.
It is driving me a little insane. I mean, again, glad the game was over early yesterday. Nice to see them hit a couple home runs at the end of the game and make it interesting, just like they did the day before when they at least brought the tying run to the plate in the ninth. I hope all you anti-strikeout people are psyched that Josh Rojas put that ball in play there in the ninth inning. Didn't that work out great? Too bad he didn't strike out. They might have had another shot with the top of the order coming up, but he hit into a double play, so you anti strikeout people can raise your hands in glee that at least he didn't strike out in that moment.
There's a lot of double plays yesterday.
I know, there sure were. Yeah. Anyway. Hit the ball and play. It's good.
Yeah.
It's really good to see. This is really frustrating, and everyone's going to kind of choose their own thing to be frustrated at. I know there's a group that is frustrated with the way the roster was constructed. There's a group that is frustrated with the amount of money spent on the team. There's a group that is frustrated with the way Scott is managing them. There's a group that is frustrated with the hitting and the hitters and the core and Julio and, you know, the guys that aren't like delivering up to the level that you would expect them to. There's a group that is frustrated with the pitching. By the way, I'm frustrated with a lot of these things, so I'm not like saying I'm not part of any of these groups. I think I'm kind of in and around a lot of these groups. I am very frustrated with the way this team has started and the way they're playing, but nothing has gotten to me quite like the defense. The defense that this team plays is incredibly aggravating. And, you know, George Kirby's going to get a lot of the grief yesterday, and he didn't pitch great. He wasn't awesome. He did give up, what, 5 runs in 3 innings, 4 innings, whatever it was. And credit to the bullpen for keeping it close and at least giving them a shot late in the game. He did have a problem with foul balls, just as Castillo did the night before. Both of them have had that problem all year long. In Castillo's case, it's surprising because of the movement he has on his pitches. In Kirby's case, maybe less so because he is around the zone as often as he is, and he does throw so many fastballs. But, you know, their inability to put away hitters is clearly hurting them at the early part of this season. But what in the world is going on with Polanco's glove? It's like it's got, what's that stuff, flubber, that's super bouncy?
Oh, yeah, I forgot about
flubber. Is that flubber?
That's the Robin Williams movie?
Is that what it's called? Is it flubber that's like super bouncy? Anything that touches it bounces really far away?
I can't say that I'm sure on that one.
I don't either. I've never seen the movie. I've never seen Flubber. And it's old. Now, the word is perfect for this exact situation because each of these are flubs in their own way. but it kind of looks at the moment as if he's got like a patch of flubber right in his glove. And every time the ball comes near it, it just bounces away. I don't know if it's in his head, if he's got the yips.
Feels yipsy.
It feels at this point yipsy. So he makes the
weird
error.
It feels like we were talking about that at second base last year.
I mean, look, Wong had his issues, and I feel like, you know, his range was obviously limited and his hitting was terrible.
This ball went.
He was also like 5'2", but I don't remember.
He had
like,
some horrendous defensive mess.
Yes. Maybe I forget about those.
We had these conversations last year.
All right, I've forgotten about those. Well, I don't know what to tell you. All I can tell you is Polanco, last night, he picks up the error, and then Kirby bails him out by getting a double play ball to him, by the way. And did you, maybe it was me, maybe I imagined it. I asked you guys, I didn't hear back from you. He has just a brutal, I mean, just an error hit right at him, right? And then Kirby gets him the ground ball, double play. And it seemed to me anyway, as if he paused for an extra moment to like look the ball all the way into the glove, stare at it, take it out, very deliberately throw it over to JP.
Yeah.
And like make sure it was done correctly.
Didn't think of that. I also had a couple pop into my mind when they were talking about the brand new turf that isn't bouncing as exactly as the way that it is until it sits there for a year. So I thought about that as an infielder. It's like you take a lot of hops off of these turf fields, you expect the same hops.
Yeah, he had the same problem in Seattle and he's had the same problem in Milwaukee. Like he's had a problem.
Totally fair point.
Gone.
But that was something that came into my mind.
All I found myself thinking was, you know, it seemed like he was like looking that sucker into his glove and being incredibly deliberate. And that one obviously didn't end up hurting him all that much because Kirby throws the ground ball double play and you move on with your life. But the drop throw at second base when Cal has the runner thrown out, that cost him 2 runs.
Yeah.
They lost by 2 runs. That's 2 runs. It's not an error, right? Because you can't assume that he can catch the ball when it's thrown to him like that. So they don't call it an error because baseball's ludicrous with that. Silly of all the silly things in baseball, the fact that that's not an error drives me up the freaking wall. Good major league player makes that play 10 times out of 10. He kicks it. He doesn't make the play. Guy's safe at second instead of being out. They drive him in. Then another guy scores with 2 outs. Guys, that's your ball game. George Kirby pitched well enough yesterday to have only given up 3 runs instead of 5. Was he great? No. Am I frustrated with him? Yes. Is he mad afterwards? Of course. Was it a good offensive performance? No. Are there lots of other things to be mad about? Of course. Like, I'm not glossing over any of those things.
But defense is the top of your list.
This defense is freaking killing them, man. And here's what's frustrating to me about it. And I am going to be very cautious in saying this. But every year you hear a complaint that it feels like a team is not playing hard when they're not winning. And I think I generally work as hard as I can not to agree with that take, even though it appears that way, because I have understood and heard from I don't know how many people in the game of baseball that when you're not hitting, it looks like you're not playing with any life. Totally get it. I totally get it. Like, they're not on base. How can it look like they're playing with any life when they don't have any opportunities to put the game in motion? That's what makes a game look lively. So I get it. I'm not going to question anybody's effort level or whether they're playing hard when they're not hitting because I understand that it looks bad, but that doesn't mean it is bad. Someone's going to have to help me on this many defensive miscues. They're not as bad as mental mistakes. If it was mental mistake after mental mistake, base running error after error, I would sit here and say, hey, guys, that's concentration issue. That's a focus issue. You got a major problem on your hands. That's a team that looks like it did at the end of Lloyd McClendon's era. Like, you can't have it. This isn't that. But I'm going to need somebody to help me a little bit on what it means when you make this many physical errors in the field. And I'm not using error in the capital E sense of the word. I'm using it in the lowercase e, if that makes sense, because that one's not a true error according to Major League Baseball, but it's an error in how you played. What does that mean? Because it feels like for Jorge Polanco, He's a good enough baseball player that he should not be making this many of those mistakes.
Right. They are contagious. I said that.
I'm sure they are.
Those feelings,
but you can't have that.
But you can't have it.
You can't have it.
Not as a veteran.
Not as a veteran leader who they've brought in to be one of the solidifying members of this team. You can't have it. And I'm not, I don't hate Polanco. And I appreciate that it's early, and I understand that he's got a long, you know, he's got a great track record of an ability to do more than this. But you can't do that. Hey, I got texters here saying he acts like he doesn't care. I don't think that's true. I don't know what would possibly make you.
I mean, if that, yeah, there's a lot of baseball players that I guess act like they don't care because there's not a lot of emotion showed throughout the course of a 90.
I don't know what you want him to do. Take his glove, spike it into the ground, and then kick it. And then we'd say, well, he's throwing a temper tantrum on the field.
There's if he was playing this kind of defense, but he was completely raking, then maybe we would be okay.
And maybe he's taking the offensive problems into the field. Maybe he's taking the fielding problems into the plate.
That's what we were saying with Wong last year.
I don't hate this guy or anything. Trust me. But this has to stop. That very well may have cost them the game last night. And if I'm George Kirby, I'm mad at myself. I'm bummed about the hitting. But and I know that for every time your defense makes an error, you get another time where they take away a hit or take away a run, and they end up helping you out. You're major leaguers. It's expected.
Yeah.
You expect the defense to be at a certain level. And right now, it absolutely is not.
Need to know.
15 minutes past every hour with Brock and Salk.
Here's what you need to know. Up first.
Yeah, yesterday I think the words I used were deja vu. And while I don't like quoting the Yankees on anything, I'll go with Yogi Berra here. Because yesterday seemed like deja vu all over again. Just the same problem seems like night after night right now. For the Mariners, who once again didn't do anything productive at the plate early. They played some iffy defense. And most importantly, they didn't get the pitching they needed from one of their top guys. This time it was George Kirby who struggled, giving up 5 runs in just 4 innings.
Kirby sets, now deals. Swinging a high fly ball, left field, and it's on its way. Bichette has left the yard to the second deck. With 2 outs and 2 strikes, Bichette homers to left field. And makes it a 3-0 Blue Jays lead.
Yeah, there's too many of these swing moments in games, right? Couple guys on, you get to 2 outs, you get to 2 strikes, you got to put them away. George Springer, Bichette, both those guys really good players, and both of them came up with huge hits to put the Blue Jays ahead, and unfortunately, you didn't see the same thing from the Mariners. The pitching's been problematic.
Back-to-back nights where we can't get our starter deeper in the ball game, and certainly that is what we pride ourselves on, is pitching and defense and getting our starter deep in the game, and we haven't been able to do that.
Yeah, the good news, I guess they showed a little fight late in this one. They scored 3 on home runs from Canzone and then 1 from Mitch Haniger.
A look in by Richards, 3-2 again to Haniger. Runner goes, swinging a fly ball deep down the left field line. Schneider going back, looking up, and goodbye baseball. 2-run home run for Mitch Haniger, fair down the left field line. And it's now the Blue Jays 5 and the Mariners 3.
Yeah, they ended up even bringing the tying run to the plate in the 9th. Unfortunately, Rojas grounds into a double play, and that's it. They're now 4-8. They've lost 6 of their last 7. Last game of the road trip will be today, and you got all eyes on Logan Gilbert. They're going to need it, honestly. Get to 5-8. You know, you're still 3 games within 500. 5-8 is going to feel a whole lot different from 4-9 coming home at that point. So huge, huge opportunity for Logan Gilbert, who, you know, we've been kind of counting on and thinking is going to be taking the mantle as one of the real leaders in this staff. Well, here's an opportunity to slam the door and do something they really need.
Here's the second thing you need to know.
Meetings galore, apparently, for the Seahawks. It's meeting season as they continue to prep for the draft. It's now just over 2 weeks away. According to Ian Rappaport, South Carolina quarterback Spencer Rattler was in Seattle for a visit with the Seahawks yesterday, so they are certainly taking some time to at least interview, meet with, and get all of the due diligence done on the quarterbacks here in this draft. Mike Garofalo reporting Florida State edge rusher Jared Verse was visiting the Seahawks on Tuesday, and he will continue the visit today. Verse is also meeting with the Bucks and the Broncos. So, again, some names that are very familiar hanging out and being around this team. They don't have a tremendous amount of draft capital, but the way this draft is shaping up, it seems like it could go in multiple different directions, and they got to be prepared for it. Seahawks also hosted Chase Claypool, the veteran wide receiver yesterday. He was a second-round pick of the Steelers, who had a couple of good seasons early, then went to Chicago and then to Miami, and he's kind of fallen off hard since then. They also signed tackle Max Purcher yesterday. He was on the Raiders practice squad last year. He's been with the Rams as well.
Here's the third thing you need to know.
Oh, the Masters gets underway tomorrow. Scottie Scheffler, of course, is the favorite. Rory McIlroy looking to complete a career Grand Slam. I was watching an interview with Rory yesterday where he named every Masters winner since the early 90s. Jeez, it was pretty impressive. He got almost tripped up a couple times and then like figured it out. And at the end, he's like, okay, 22 Scheffler, 23 Rahm, 24 Rory McIlroy, good for him. Like, it's what he needs, man. He's done everything else that he needs to do, but this is the last step in his career, Grand Slam.
He's reached out to Butch Harmon to work with him, and I thought the comment he had about his daughter, his little daughter, Poppy, he said he had to go. She said, where are you going? He said, I'm going to go get a lesson. She said, you already know how to play golf. And I think working with Butch is really could be the thing that unlocks it for him, because Butch is a great instructor at just letting players play the way they want to play and helping remind them that they're good at the game. Rory isn't playing the par three. He's not doing as many practice rounds. I think he's trying a different way to solve the riddle. The slam's out there. He's the only person for whom everyone else that they win this week, they win the Masters. If he wins this week, he wins the slam. And that's a lot.
Yeah, it's a lot of pressure that he plays with. Tiger will be out there. By the way, that was Scott Van Pelt, who's going to join us at 7:30. Tiger reportedly had a great practice round on Monday. Remember, he withdrew after making the cut in 2023. So that will get going tomorrow. And, of course, the Kraken, they won 5-0 in Arizona yesterday. That's not even really the story, though. The story is Shane Wright.
Gunther, the rookie, picked off by Seattle's Shane Wright. Forward lines, defense bearings, top of your screen. Shane Wright stinks it home. Shane Wright and the Kraken are off and running with 18:52 left in period one.
Yeah, how about that? He got on the board early. That is 3 goals and an assist in the 4 games that he's played since being called up.
Awesome.
Really, really good to see. And not just that, he's going to the dirty areas on the ice. Very promising. Although I will say all of those have come against the Ducks, Sharks, and Coyotes, arguably the 3 worst teams in the league. All right, that's everything you need to know. 4:15 every hour here in the Brock and Salk Show. So it sounds like Rory's kind of using my strategy of not warming up as much. Right?
How's it work for you?
Well, it worked pretty well, to be honest with you. I played better. Like, maybe he feels like he's getting older and he only has so many good swings in there before fatigue becomes a factor. He's got to play 4 rounds in 4 days. You know, he's got a little pressure on him, slightly more than I do. And so maybe he's just borrowing the same philosophy I have. No more warm-ups. Just go out there and play, man. Don't exhaust yourself.
I'm sure that's easy for a guy as heady as him to just not let it bother him the whole time he's not working.
Yeah, just not going to do it. Out. Just going to head out there.
Just going to go have a soda. And
just have some fun. Yeah, have a little fun out there. All right. More from Scott Van Pelt, who will join us from Augusta coming up an hour from now before we do it. Jeff Passan yesterday, and it was a wide-ranging discussion. Brock was fascinated by one part of this, and my guess is he'll keep coming back to it over and over again because it hits home for him, just as I'm sure it will for a lot of you, especially if you are the parent of somebody playing baseball in high school, in middle school, even in Little League. You're going to want to listen to what Jeff says next. It's Brock and Salk, Seattle Sports on 710.
This is Brock and Salk,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studio, weekdays 6 to 10
on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app.
All right, kind of bouncing around today. We do have another Brock Heward draft profile coming up in 30 minutes. Looking forward to that. Good one today, Brock. What do we got? We got a first
round
pick today.
I like this guy just a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot. Not a first rounder because the production, what he was asked to do as a defensive lineman,
okay,
was not earth shattering. In fact, like the career numbers, you look at him and go, no way. I mean, look at what he's hardly done anything. But he was part of a blue wall that was a national champion, and I like guys like
that. Okay, well, that sounds good. All right, we'll get to that coming up here in a half hour. Right now, it's time on time this week, which is great. Jeff Passan joining us from ESPN. Talk a little baseball. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning. Oh, glad to be coming into the chuckle hut there, Salk.
That's us. Yeah, it's like a comedy show here on the Brock and Salk Show. We'll get to the Mariners. I want to start broader before we talk about our 4-7 baseball team that hasn't really.
I was going to say, I bet you do want to start on some subject other than the Mariners.
Start somewhere else. 4-7. They've probably played closer to 2-9. It's not been a good start. But the biggest story in America right now, sports wise, of course, has been the women's tournament and Caitlin Clark and just the buzz of all of it. I would assume that you've been caught up in that as well.
I was among the 18.7 million, yes.
I would assume so. Okay, so here's my question. To bring it back to baseball, what would it take for baseball to create the kind of buzz that women's college basketball has had for the last 2 weeks?
Well, let's focus, I think, on specifically what you said. You were not talking just about women's college basketball, the sport, right?
Right.
What name did you say in there?
I might have mentioned Caitlin Clark's name.
Yeah. And look, that's what it is, right? I mean, it is a star of stars. And to me, that's how this happens. And it happened once before, back in like 98. I mean, when Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were doing their thing, all of America was tuned in, right?
Mm-hmm.
And baseball's cultural resonance was no greater in 1998 than it is, like, just generally speaking, than it had been any time, you know, in the 20 years prior, probably. I understand baseball was on, it was in the midst of an interesting run. You know, the Yankees dynasty was just starting, which kind of turns fans off a little bit because it's the Yankees. But it was stars. And that's why I'm going to tie this back to something that it may not seem on the surface ties well to it. That's why this starting pitching injury crisis frightens me so much.
Mm-hmm.
It's because Major League Baseball is essentially saying that half of our player population is being put in a position of such peril that we're willing to put them out there and allow them, because of what we encourage our pitchers to do, allow them to be in harm's way. And in doing so, we are taking stars that could be made, and we are ridding them from our sport because of injuries. Mm. And to me, what baseball has long been missing is that transcendent star. Shohei Ohtani is the closest thing we've seen to it, and still it was not enough to get everyone to watch. So I think it is somebody who is so above and beyond ridiculously good that when you're in the office or when you're with your friends, you can bring him up in conversation and, you know, not be like, oh, you're talking about that. Like if you were with somebody this weekend and you were talking about Caitlin Clark, it's almost like if the other person wasn't conversant in her or in women's basketball, they were the ones who were missing out.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I think, is where baseball can go. And I don't know who that person's going to be, but there's no quick fix. There's no like silver bullet. I mean, you know, we look at a league like the NBA, guys, that has a ton of stars, and the women's final outrated every NBA game of like the last how many years? I think like 10, something like that.
Golf had Tiger, total game changer. Women's basketball has now had Caitlin. I think the NBA had Jordan in the 80s that really propelled. And there were other stars, obviously, in all of these.
Magic and Bird before that.
Sure, absolutely. There were certainly other stars. The NFL saw Tom Brady win 7 Super Bowls over 20 years, something that nobody thought ever could be done. Can you craft that player in baseball, Jeffrey? Can you say, okay, this is what you need for this star to be like?
No, I mean, if I were to create a player, it would have been someone like Ohtani, who's doing something that's never been done.
And yet it's not sustainable. And to your point,
it's not sustainable. It's not just that Yeah, it's not just that it's not sustainable. I think that it wasn't enough. Like, it wasn't enough to get everyone tuned in. I think with baseball, part of that, let's put it this way. If Ohtani were, like, chasing a record, maybe that would have been a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
But probably not. I mean, he just happened to be on a team that was terrible for the entirety of his career. Like, Dan just stunk. And there was no record that he was chasing. He was just, like, it was kind of boring. He was being really consistent. Like, I'm sorry, but, like, super consistent performance does not make you say, you know what, I'm going to tune in.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, I think baseball is one of those games. It's what makes Sosa and McGuire so remarkable. Baseball is not one of those games that breeds must-watch individuals. And so to see, you know, in hindsight, how they captured just the entire country back in 98. I mean, it was awesome. And I really wish I'd been covering baseball back then, because it would have been so much fun.
You mentioned the arm injuries. I know that one of the conversations here is about the pitch clock, and the union has brought it up. Do you believe, yeah. I mean, you've written the book on it quite literally, the arm. Is there any evidence at all to suggest that the pitch clock is factoring into these arm injuries?
Zero. But, and this is a really important but, you still should study it. You still should look into it. That's where we are with this. Every single element of a pitcher's game deserves a really keen eye on it. And it's because we don't know. And I am, you know, I'm the guy who spent 4 years studying it, and I don't know. And that was, I read back through, there was a particular chapter in the arm that was meant to, I remember writing it, and it was like, I'm going to try and predict the future, which is a scary thing to do when you're a writer, because the likelihood that egg ends up on your face, even if you know the subject forward and backward, is pretty strong. And I went back and I looked through this chapter, and for the most part, it kind of holds up. But even with that, guys, I still wrote that book and finished that book without having an answer after 4 years, which was a deeply dissatisfying thing for me personally. It's like, you know, you devote enough time to a subject and you still feel like you don't have an answer. Like, what, you know, you can only take so much solace in the journey, right? I went into that book thinking I'm going to find someone, something, and come out of it and say, this is the problem. No, there is no silver bullet. There is no panacea. There's just better process and better ideals. And the way that guy's pitch right now, it's very simple. It's just, it does not lead to long-term health. And like I hate to bring it home here, but the one thing I think we do know pretty well at this point, don't know if it's causative, do know pretty well that it's correlated. The harder you throw, the likelier you are to get hurt. And the Seattle Mariners got a lot of hard throwing pitchers.
Yep.
I mean, a lot. And, you know, it is, I hate to say it, not with all of them, hopefully. There are outliers, but I fear that it's just a matter of time. And just to put a bow on your original question here, because, you know, I can talk about this for hours. I don't think it's the pitch clock, but I do think it's important that some pitchers do think it's the pitch clock, and they're the ones out there, and they know better than anyone how they feel. And so it's incumbent on Major League Baseball to at very least listen to them and add that to whatever they're looking into right now, especially if that's the price that they have to pay for the modern pitchers to sit down and talk with them and give their insight, which has not happened to this point. And if you're doing a study that doesn't include the stakeholders in this, it's an incomplete study.
I promise, Mariner fans, we will get to Julio in the Mariners in just 1 second. Let me just finish this off with what is really scary to me, Jeffrey, is I've got a child, as you would term him. I've got a child of my own at 14. Quote, I started following the injury patterns and injury rates in the year 2000. This is Dr. James Andrews. Back in those days, I did about 8 or 9 Tommy Johns per year on high school and younger kids. The large majority of Tommy Johns were at the major league level, then the minor league level, then the college level, and maybe a handful of high school kids. In today's situation, whole thing's flipped. The largest number is youth baseball. They've surpassed what's being done in the major leagues, and that is a terrible situation. He says the obsession with velocity and spin at the youth levels having a devastating impact on arms and the game itself. Final quote, these kids are throwing 90 their junior year of high school, which I just watched yesterday. The ligament itself can't withstand that kind of force. We've learned in a research lab that baseball is a developmental sport. The Tommy John ligament matures at 26. In high school, the red line where the forces go beyond the tensile properties of the ligament is 80. Jeff, they're throwing 80 as eighth graders. This is kind of scary stuff to yours truly and to what you said to the game of baseball overall if it is not sustainable biologically.
So my kid comes home from summer camp. You know, we have tried to keep him away from the absolute racket that is like travel ball, and in large part because the idea of him going and throwing all the time and playing year-round baseball and that is destroying kids' arms. My kid gets home and he will come as a shock to you because I am decidedly not. But he's a tall kid and he's got an arm that moves very fast, but he only weighed like 155 pounds. And the first thing he says is, I need to gain weight, right? I need to get bigger. I need to get stronger. And I'm like, okay, that's an admirable goal. Like why? And the answer is I got to throw harder. Mm. Now I understand his motivations there, because let's look, if you want to pitch in college as he does, or play in college as is a goal of his, and he's a very, very goal oriented person. The only way you're going to get on the radar of college coaches is if you hit 90.
Yeah.
Like that is just a truth of yes. where things have gone. And so I sit here and you know, I am literally the guy who wrote the book on the subject, and I'm watching my child walk exactly toward the area where I'm suggesting to other parents, like it's like Anakin in the really bad Star Wars movie where his whole body gets burned off and he's going, no, it's like slow motion, me seeing the kid going toward that. And I can't say to him, no, don't. I mean, I'm not going to put a restrictor plate on his life. He understands the consequences. He understands he's a smart enough kid where he gets everything that's in play here. This is just the way for him to do it right now. You want to talk about a sport that's broken, guys? It's not broken because all of the players that have gotten hurt at the big league level are getting hurt. It's broken because the incentive structure is such that it's beginning at the youth level.
Mm-hmm. Good point.
Change that, yeah. You change the game.
Great stuff. All right, Jeff, let's, because we still have another 10 minutes here, talk about this 4-7 Mariner team. As I said, they've probably played closer to 2-9 baseball. How serious a problem is it?
I'm not there yet. We do this every year, guys. Sometimes it's the Mariners. Sometimes it's other teams that start off really bad. This may be cold comfort,
But the fact that they're 4-7 when, like, everybody on the team but Ty France can't hit right now is actually a good thing, because you're right. By run differential, I believe they've got the fourth worst run differential in baseball right now, and the other three teams are really bad. Like, the Marlins, who have one win, it's the White Sox, who have one win, and it's the Rockies, I believe, who are a total disaster. And then it's the Mariners right there. So I look at that and say, okay, having four at this point is better than where they should be. Beyond the hitting, if you go and look at the differences between ERA and fielding independent pitching, which is it's a pretty simple stat, actually, that takes into account the walks, strikeouts, and home runs that you've allowed. It essentially tries to and does a pretty decent job of predicting future performance. And when there's a big gap between ERA and FIP, that means that there's going to be some positive regression to the mean. And I believe every Mariner starter has a higher ERA. In Luis Castillo's case, a significantly higher ERA than his FIP, which means it's probably gonna get better. That being said,
does it if the defense doesn't get better?
I was just going to say,
okay,
part of it is the defensive issues, and they need to clean that up. But ultimately, this team's going to be, we know the pitching's going to be good. As long as it's healthy, pitching's going to be good. The bats, you know, the bats just need to figure it out, because, and everyone, Julio needs to figure it out. Crawford needs to figure it out. The new guys need to figure it out. Everyone needs to figure it out, or otherwise this thing's just going to spiral and get pretty gnarly.
Jeffrey, give the Mariner fan out there the first couple places that Jeff Passan goes to when you know you're going to jump on with us every Tuesday throughout the entire season, and we love it, and our audience loves it. And I know you do your homework. So what are a few of the places you just mentioned? FIP right there. And I think that's a great start and a great point. What are some of the other kind of next level numbers that you dig into, that you look at, that you really do feel like, oh boy, this is going to go off the rails, or this is going to come back to the mean?
I know this is a dissatisfactory answer. I still think it's just too early to glean anything, because the stuff like hard hit rate and fastball velocity and other things that I tend to look at, mm-hmm. they haven't stabilized at this point. And it usually takes a month to get that stability in a lot of those numbers. So I do go to Fangraphs and I go to Baseball Savant. Those are, those are like my two binkies. And those are the things that I've lean on to help educate me. And, I watch games and my eyes tell me one thing, but those are the places that have the numbers that tell me whether my eyes are lying to me. My eyes are not lying right now. It's not good.
What do we make of Julio's kind of streakiness to start his career? We've seen him look like the best player of all time, and we've seen him go through these stretches where he's really struggling. Is that likely to just be who he is? Is that something guys can find their way out of? What do you make of the streakiness?
Can I add just one little component to that too, and throw one other little angle on that, Jeffrey? Is it 6'3", 230? Does that play a role of it, just with the amount of size and the amount of moving parts you have on such an amazing, talented, but big athlete?
Yeah. I mean, there's nothing you can do about that. Like that's what you got, It doesn't look like 230. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like if you look at him, you would say like 6'3", 210. He carries that 230 very well. It's very well proportioned. So I don't think there's going to be a whole lot changing the body, but there are players, Mike, who that's who they are. I'm not there with Julio yet because I still think he's too young. I don't think that, I don't think he's a finished product by any means. And I think I think consistency is something that can be learned, and that he's still trying to figure out some of the ways to do that.
How about swing and miss percentage? How about just the swing and miss? Is there a corollary to quarterback accuracy? You know, when I look at quarterbacks and there's a certain level, Jeff, that, man, they've got just some innate God-given accuracy and command, and usually those numbers don't grow tremendously. You kind of are what you are. I mean, systems can change that, but can you see a swing and miss percentage dramatically improve over the course of time?
Yes. Look at Ronald Acuna Jr.'s numbers last year. Strikeout rate in particular is the way that manifests itself. And he cut his strikeout rate by more than 50% last year. So, yes, it is possible. And I think that comes with the mastery, or as close as one can get to mastery, of hitting. And I think you were telling a story last week, Mike, about how you guys were watching him hit off the traject machine, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
I think that those sorts of tools that exist now that didn't exist in the past will help in that regard. And that when you have somebody who's so innately physically talented, he's the kind of person who can take that leap at some point. But let's just, like, elephant in the room here. The hitting is an issue because of the strikeouts. I believe they have the highest strikeout rate in baseball. Last I looked, I'm not doing that thing, Brock, where I'm in front of my computer today, but check me on this. I believe the Mariners' strikeout rate this year is 28.6%.
Yeah, they've been in the bottom five, whatever it is. I mean, the strikeouts have been problematic. I'm going to continue to argue that, you know, the bigger problem is they haven't hit for any power. They have almost no power whatsoever. They haven't walked nearly enough either. And when you walk and hit home runs, it makes those strikeouts feel not so serious.
That's what the Minnesota Twins did last year, and it took them to the playoffs. I believe they had the worst strikeout rate in baseball, and they still won their division, and they did it because they walked a lot and they hit tanks. And you're absolutely right with that.
All right, Jeff. Well, let's end on that. I don't think we've ever said hit those tanks. Words here on this hit show. Tanks. Mike, you're absolutely right. I'm shocked. Jeez. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know what to do with myself. The rest of the week is going to be confusing for me, but I appreciate the kind words.
Oh, I'm so sorry I gave you an existential crisis. Boo-hoo.
Jeff, thank you. As always, we'll talk next week.
All right, boys, take care.
Yeah, an existential crisis because Jeff agreed with me. I don't know if he quite has that one right, but I appreciate the thought from Mr. Passan. All right. Things did not improve, by the way, since then. Things just got a little bit worse last night as they just played the exact same game. It felt like they had played the night before. Coming up next, I'm going to shift gears because we got a real busy day. Scott Van Pelt's going to join us at 7:30. We're going to talk some draft at 9:30 with Bruce Feldman. But I saw something yesterday. In fact, one of you, I think Maura, you might have sent this over from Mike Sando. And it really has me up in my head because it feels like the Seahawks may have the most polarizing player, at least in terms of evaluation, in the league. And I don't know what to make of it. It's next on Brock and Salk.